Let me ask you this question. Do you see any parallel between the situation of the Negro, a member of what they call a subculture, vis-a-vis the great American machine, and the situation of the white Southerner, who is a member of a subculture, a defeated nationalism, lives in a special box of attitudes and a special philosophy and special prejudices. Him vis-a-vis the big American machine. You see any parallel there?
Yeah, I guess it's probably very similar. And with the experience, I think people's reactions to it are similar also, that you get the Southerners that are now very cosmopolitan, white Southerners, that want to completely reject the Southern experience, and you get the Negro middle class that wants to completely reject his Negro experience from slavery.
As I understood you to say earlier, are you in favor of a kind of cultural pluralism which is not competitive but appreciative? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of expressing it. And I think that the Southerners, both white and Negro, probably have a lot more in common than they realize. That right now it's the structures of our society which segregated us on the basis of race that really keep us from getting to know the fact that we probably are much closer to one another than anybody else in America.
A young lady with whom I was talking at Howard some time back said to me that she had more optimism for the Southern settlement than for the Northern settlement between the races, on the account of the shared history, the same land the people lived on, and the same history lived through, even though you might now find Pistol Point. Beyond that, the possibility of a human recognition that she could not understand, she said, in Harlem or Detroit or Chicago, she being raised on a Southern farm.
Yeah, I think that this would be the general experience of most Negroes who move north, and certainly mine. In the days when I was in the north in school, most of my friends, since there were very few Negroes on the campus, turned out to be white Southerners. And we found that we had a great deal more in common than, say, I did with many of the Northern students. I think this is true in the movement. We've watched Northern whites come down and try to work with us. But they almost never really get along as well as the Southern whites who are working with us. For instance, just in the matter of the religious ethos that we share in the South, the old gospel hymns, out of which, and spirituals out of which many of the freedom songs come, white Southerners can tend to sing these a little better. They feel them a little more. It's much easier for them once they become liberated intellectually and socially to become more deeply personally involved in the movement.
Charles Evers was talking to me several weeks ago, and I asked him why didn't he leave Mississippi. Mm-hmm. He said, well, he thought they would win there because, he said, these Mississippians, the worst segregationist, is raised in some sort of a simple culture which is, insists on respecting courage, blank courage, brute courage. He said the Negro shows this and stands up with it. Mm-hmm. this is a grudging respect, even with dislike may come out of it. Mm-hmm. That the respect is there as a basis for something to go on. Second, he said, but this segregationist, once he crosses the line to deal with you, with the Negro, he's not going to lie because he's crossed the line already inside himself.
Yeah.
So there's some basis for a reconciliation on those two lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it makes a great deal of sense. I hadn't thought of it that way. But I think that our experience, even in the bitterest situations, we tend to put this trust in nonviolence to overcome this barrier. That in Albany, Georgia, for instance, in spite of the fact that we were at war in terms of politics and the social structures, Chief Pritchett and I had a very close personal friendship going on through this time.
How did that work out, literally, specifically?
Well, I almost became his counselor and his pastor over the tremendous guilt that he had over being involved in perpetuating a police state. And every time I'd go in the jail, he'd want to call me in and just talk some. And we found it quite possible.
What did he say?
Old things like, for instance, when the 75 ministers went to jail, he talked a good deal about, oh, I don't want to, I don't want to put men of God in jail. He said, I know they're sincere about what they're doing. He said, and you all don't know how it makes me feel to have to do this. He even asked if we could get Dr. King to intercede to get him a job as a federal marshal so that he could get out of this system.
Join the other side.
Yeah. Well, and it was... I think that at the same time, I had no illusions about his being... very much a part of this system. And I think that this represented not a complete, it represented a genuine schizophrenia on his part. I would think that even Adolf Eichmann would probably be a rather personable individual if you'd sit down with him. I remember in Mississippi going to get some of our staff members out of jail who had been beaten up. And when I went there, I started a conversation with the sheriff and the chief of police, and we were able to relate very warmly as persons. And we talked about our families, and we joked about the weather and normal conversational banter. And I was convinced that these were Christian gentlemen. And yet here was a Negro girl on our staff who is one of the most sensitive and delicate creatures I know, that they had beaten for an hour and a half with blackjacks.
The same persons.
And it shocked me when I came out and saw her, when she came out of jail, and her face was all bruised and her eyes swollen and scars and blood still in her hair. And I asked her who beat her, and she said, those two stand that you were talking to right there. Now, this is the problem we're really fighting, that the Southerner, who is a very warm and personable human being, when caught in this system, responds almost to a kind of a mob psychosis. We've had some experiences where, you know, they almost don't face this. It's almost like they've, like a man dissociates himself from his conscience when he goes to war. In their dealings with Negroes, they are perpetuating a sacred way of life, so that anything they have to do to perpetuate this sacred way of life is okay. Now, if we can ever get the white Southerner and the Negro Southerner to but be free of this system that makes them respond this way. I think that certainly we will have much more rapport and much better climate in the South than we have in the North.
Baldwin has written somewhere, in his last book, that the Southern mob, the people actually on the streets beating up Negroes, or perhaps the police in the jail cell, do not represent the will of the Southern white majority. Now, this question evokes all sorts of, this statement evokes all sorts of different responses, you can well imagine. How do you respond to it?
Well, it's, I can say that that's true, but at the same time, I can say that it's not quite true. That the problem of the white majority in the South is that it has no guts and integrity left, I think.
No leadership.
Yeah. That Alabama responds to George Wallace. And this means that Alabama, who elects George Wallace, has to bear the responsibility for his inflammatory speeches, which get children killed and which create a climate where will create a police state. Now, cornering these people individually, you get something completely different. But in terms of their fear of integration, whether this is a kind of paranoia or I don't know, the I keep, when you were saying this, I thought of well, several things that have been written, you know, that show this kind of ambiguity. The pleasant, personable, humorous Southerner who's also capable of great sadism.
True.
Yeah. And I don't know what the source of this sickness is. Now, many people have analyzed it. I mean, have described it. But I don't know whether I've really come up with somebody that's been able to really diagnose it, the nature of this social illness. Baldwin and Sartre developed the sexual angle.
Well, they're outside. They don't know anything about the South.
That's true.
Neither one of them. Not
but
a thing.
Tennessee Williams, too, you know, pulls this in a great deal.
It's an element, clearly, but that's not. Let me ask you, try this and see how you respond to it. I don't know how much money to put on this card, but I'll try it. That the Southerner is, in a way, like the Negro. He is a person who is outside of a dominant culture and is defending, in a different perspective, his identity. Mm-hmm. As the Negro has been trying to find an identity in his culture, and has felt none in the major American culture, trying to find an identity, a role, in a very crucial way. And this is, of course, written about at great length, it's the Negro search for identity. But the white Southerner who thought he had one once, you see, or looking back thought his grandfather did, now feels himself, his very identity threatened. Not just ways of life, but identity, his whole role, his whole social function, his existence threatened. In a mistaken way, he has elected to stake his identity on a pattern of life which involves segregation. These are symptoms of life, not the core of life. But he's made those symbols and symptoms the essence. They stand for the essence. He hasn't been able to define the problem for himself. So he, it's a saving his very identity, his very existence is dependent upon enforcing this among several other symbols.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense or part sense?
Yeah, I can think so. When you couple with it, I think the real political threat that the white Southerner feels in hardcore areas. I mean, well, in areas of Negro majority, such as the Mississippi Delta. People tell me who've talked with the white people about around Selma, Alabama, that there was a real fear of and recollection of Reconstruction, even, that still pervaded the mind of the average white person around Selma.
This is played up. It's not a folk memory. It's a deliberately cultivated piece of propaganda, I feel.
And they couple with this the... the myths, really. The sex myth, the communist myth, and all of these things tend to feed on... Or to feed this neurosis a great deal, and so you really get a kind of defensiveness that's very hard to cope with, and I think both the church and the government tend to make a mistake in trying to cope with it when they cope with it through judgment. I certainly believe in federal law and in federal enforcement of law and in the use of troops. But, for instance, the way in which Eisenhower used troops was almost, in Little Rock, was a defense of his ego and his the fact that he was insulted. The issue of law, federal law enforcement was never really communicated to the South, and nobody really attempted to do this. I think almost the same thing happened to Kennedy, that they felt betrayed by Ross Barnett, and they responded with a show of power. Now, at this time, Kennedy himself had never, or Eisenhower, had ever made any attempt to communicate to the South the meaning of a republic. Nobody has ever attempted to do any education in the South except the White Citizens Council and the Klan. And I think many of these people are, I'd almost say that the little experience I've had in reading about these people is that they are genuinely sick, and they play on the social sickness for leadership. So that you find the South with nobody really trying to tell them what the moral and cultural issues are of the day.
Let's switch this a little bit now. That is so true that, you know, and the real pathology in some of these people that I have met face to face. Let's take something else. Let's take a man almost at random. Opposite number, maybe. I don't know the man. Don't think about him, really. I'm taking a quote now from Gallamison a few weeks ago. I would rather see the public school system destroyed than not conform to the timetable of integration. Mm-hmm. Maybe the school system has already run its course anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What does that remark convey to you about motivation?
I think he's speaking out of a great passion, and he's not really, it's more heat than light, I'd say. But I know what he's trying to say. Now, the way I would interpret that same feeling when I have it is that, one of my little talks about education is that Dr. Conant, in his books, has continually lambasted American education. Now, nobody really takes this seriously. They take it intellectually. But the Negro is really experiencing daily everything that Dr. Conant is talking about times 10, multiply. Now, when Glamison says something like this, he's saying that the experience of public education for Negroes is such a wasted enterprise that it just as well not exist for the good that it's doing to the masses of Negroes. Now, I think his narrowness is that he's only seeing this happening to Negroes. But the same thing is almost happening to the average white person, too, in public education. Now, I think that he makes a mistake when he doesn't point this out, that he makes enemies of the white community. And they count him then as irresponsible and hot-headed. And in a sense, he is. When he says this kind of thing, without putting it in its total educational perspective. But I guess, I don't know whether this was said in a press statement.
A TV interview.
Mm-hmm. These kinds of things, you can get caught sometimes
sure,
into.
Sure.
But I would say that Lamerson is a Presbyterian minister. An educated man himself would have a great deal of respect for education. And the thing he's saying is that the education we're getting now, that I agree that it would be much better for us to just say that, well, and this is what's going to happen in the school situation.
In New York
and in general, that nobody would deal with Coleman's theories. I mean, you wouldn't get the kind of rash readjustment of curriculum and everything else that's needed just on the basis of a book. But when a book and a social movement coincide, now what's going to happen is when Glamison begins to get a little time to do some thinking and reading about this, see, Martin Luther King really didn't have, he responded to the passion and need of a situation. It wasn't until several months later, when he began to mellow and reflect on it, that he put it in the ideological context of nonviolence and began to draw on this tradition and develop an ideology to go with his movement. Now, I would think that Glamison is going to begin to in fact, Dr. King and I were talking about this yesterday, and he was saying some of these things, and we were encouraging him to talk to Glamison, and try to find a meeting where we can sit down with some of these school boycott leaders and rent strike leaders, and see if we can't. Well, it sounds rather paternalistic. We don't mean it in that sense, but help them to mature a little faster as revolutionaries. They've got something genuine. They've got a folk movement which is going to be with us for a long time, and that we really should be sharing with one another what we've learned.
Here's an energy, a dynamism of change, which is wasting itself on busing, a problem of busing. That's your idea?
Yeah. That's it. And this isn't the problem at all. In fact, I dare say that integration. See, the problem, these integration becomes a problem. Negro schools become a problem mainly because of the small percentage of money in America that's spent on any kind of education.
Let's start with that.
Yeah.
The money is trivial compared to what it should be.
Yeah.
What about a city like Washington, D.C.? How do you integrate the schools of Washington or the schools mm-hmm. of New York 15 years from now when there won't be any white people around to integrate?
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying, that we've got to get, especially in schools, beyond the question of integration. The Negro in the South, see, I think has
beyond the question of integration.
Yeah.
That is a transitional problem, is that right?
I think so. Now, I think the Negro in the South has felt that the problem was, and in a good measure he was correct. You see, in Mississippi, he'd see the statistics that $206 a year spent on Negro education, on white education, a white student in LaFleur County, $35 spent on a Negro kid. So that he realizes that there's no need, it's almost impossible, it's too long to get this Negro's education up to $200. So the rate of gradualism just would just kill us. So he's got to integrate this $200 school system. Now, what the Northern Negro has done is taken the Southern problem, I mean the Southern analysis, as integration being the answer to everything, and tried to slap it on a situation where the problem isn't so much segregation as it is urbanization.
Now, just last week, I was sitting with Dr. Ann Hedgen, you know, who's the most wonderful woman who's been a great help to me, and we were talking about the busing business, and she said, well, the busing is a facade, the busing is done all the time, and we haven't come to grips with this business just in passing. But she, I said, what about Washington? She said, oh, bring them from Virginia.
Mm-hmm. No, well,
I can't see the logic of myself of sending the buses to Virginia. How do you get a political implementation of that, to bring white children in from Virginia to put them into Washington, D.C. schools?
But what you do in coping with the... You see, in coping with the education problem, you don't really... This is the reason we say the problem has to be taken in its totality. That you get education dependent being de facto because of housing. You get housing segregated partially because of jobs. You get jobs segregated mainly because Negroes are not represented in the political structure. Now, this is the reason we're centering more and more now our fight on political representation. That if Negroes represent 34% of the population in Alabama, somehow they ought to have 34% of the representation in state legislatures. Now, and that when you reapportion to exclude Negroes from representation, you're really being unconstitutional. Now, when Negroes are equally represented, are proportionally represented in government, then it doesn't become... See, Washington's a problem because white people from the South, the District of Columbia Committee, is mainly dominated by Southerners. So that Negroes blame it on the South, and they blame it then on segregation. In New York, the same thing is true. It's white people who are taking the blame for Negro education. Now, I think that when you get some of these same Negroes, and if I were mayor in New York, I'd have put Glamison on this committee a long time ago and give him the responsibility of drawing up the school plan with somebody. And when he begins to be representative and have the responsibility for actually solving the problem, he will begin to see the problem in its depth. And you have, a means of solution then. But until you actually get representative government or until Negroes are represented in the administration and in the government bureaucracy so that they take the responsibility for dealing with some of these problems where they have racial overtones, you're going to get segregation as the main focusing point. Now, I don't know whether we have enough time to do this.
That's the problem right there. How do you contain the problem, even with the best will in the world, to accomplish this?
Yeah. And I don't know that I have any solutions. I think right now, if we could once get people to see the problem, to see racism as a symptom, or in a sense, racism is mainly the I don't know what to call it. It's not the problem itself, but it provides such a great frame of reference for so many problems that we're not really facing any of the problems of a modern democracy because we've got to fight over racism. Congress can't face urban transit or urban renewal mainly because of the Southern power bloc. And if you could once get democracy really functioning on an equal basis for all of its citizens, you might be able to cope with these problems.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Go ahead.
I thought I heard your voice coming to the period. My question is this. Every movement, every person, tends to become a prisoner of his own rhetoric,
yeah.
His own slogans, his own states about himself to himself. To what extent has this happened in the, quote, Negro movement? Now, you were giving what might be an example a moment ago. You said integration has become, for the New York school system or even busing, mm-hmm. a slogan which may conceal the realities, the problem, the fundamental realities of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an argument, by the way, against integration. As
no.
But it's a question of self-deception that can occur around the world as an example of a rhetoric,
yeah.
As a trap.
Well, this, I think, is a trap that all leaders of mass movements fall into. You've got to have slogans, you've got to have rallying points to keep the little people informed. And yet, way down deep, you know that the problems aren't quite so simple. Now, real creativity and I think the two things that can save you from this. One is, real creativity and continually feeding your movement new ideas. We in the South have been able to. Just moving from bus boycotts to freedom rides to sit-ins to voter registration to massive direct action has kept us from having any pat answers to anything. And so the movements continue to evolve and grow. And I think the Northern movement will do this too. The other thing is enough humility to admit that you're wrong. And I think Dr. King certainly exemplifies this.
In what specific way are you?
Well, when you follow a slogan and it gets you into trouble.
Which slogan are we talking about now?
Oh, let me see. Well, I think of one case was when Dr. King and was really pulled into this with the Birmingham people demanding that 25 policemen be hired by a certain date. And really, this came out of a press conference, which had not really been cleared. And I think...
How? I mean, the press conference with Dr. King with...
With a group of Birmingham leaders.
It hadn't been cleared with whom?
I mean, it hadn't really been thoroughly discussed and analyzed. It was a slogan, you see, to for public relations value, for massive. Something had to be done to give the people of Birmingham some hope that large-scale bombings and mass murders were not going to follow this church bombing, because this really threatened So, the feeling in Birmingham is that policemen have been related to and, in fact, involved with the bombings. So that one of our answers, the slogans, was Negro policemen would guarantee us some law enforcement. So, we demand then to put a stop to these bombings, 25 Negro policemen. Now, There were problems connected with this, but Dr. King, when he saw the problems, in some sense admitted that this was not possible, and that we wouldn't maybe stage demonstrations on the basis of this demand for 25 policemen. Excuse me a minute.
End of tape 2, conversation with Mr. Andy Young. See tape 3.